I have a feeling that some of you know the name of Tiffany Jewell, who is a best-selling author several times over. The author of books like This Book is Anti-Racist or The Anti-Racist Kid. Her latest book is titled Everything I Learned About Racism, I Learned in School. This book is in many respects a hard-hitting indictment of the racism that Tiffany Jewell experienced throughout nearly all of her schooling in Syracuse, New York. But she is now looking back on that experience in a sense, with wise eyes and understanding some of what happened to her within a wider context. And her voice is her book is a fascinating one, which is, in her own words, part memoir, part anthology, part history, part social commentary, and part something else. A really interesting book that left me really thinking about all kinds of things that I tend to take for granted. I think it's an important book for many people to read. It's published by VersaFi, a division of HarperCollins, again titled Everything I Learned About Racism, I Learned in School. Tiffany Jewell, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited that I can talk with you. I think one thing that's really important right off the bat is to talk about who you were, or maybe the whole matter of labels and how you were labeled. And obviously, it was important to you because it's one of the first things you go into in your book. You talk about being light-skinned, black, biracial, cisgender, female. And yet, when it came to filling out forms for a school, there was no box that checked all of that off, and right. so there were very right. sort of simple labels. Explain how you tended to be labeled, because I think that has a whole lot to do about what you experienced and what you saw in school.
For sure. So growing up, my sister and I have a twin sister, and we are light skin. Our dad's black, our mom's white, like many other kids in the United States. We lived in a single parent home with our white mom. And it wasn't until we were juniors or seniors in high school that we found out that our school labeled us as white. All throughout my own knowledge and stuff, I've always known I'm biracial, maybe just called it something else like mixed. And known that I am white and black and a whole person, but our school, someone somewhere in the district labeled us white and probably did the same for other biracial kids, other kids of the global majority living with white folks. We don't know the extent of that, but it had a huge impact, I think, on how our schools looked at us and how they treated us and the opportunities and advantages we got. I share in the book, I was tracked into the we called it Team One, but it was the track that was you were college bound. Whether you know it or not, you're going to go to college. And a lot of my darker skinned peers were not tracked in the same way when we went to middle school. And, I was a hard worker and I got good grades. And so did all of my classmates. We were all hard workers and got good grades and all of that. And so the book is a lot of reflection on me understanding my identity in different parts of my life, but also the way that schooling kind of pushed us in one direction or another.
Right. And so what's so intriguing is that this is a book by a black woman, but in a sense not telling the black story that we maybe expect you to be telling us from the title of the book. Mm-hmm. That in fact what you are writing mm-hmm. about as much as anything is how unfairly other students were treated versus the way you were treated, the privilege that you were extended simply because the box marked W was checked off in terms of mm-hmm. who you were. So it seems to me that you're in a position to write this book and to tell this story from a fairly rare perspective, even though what you ultimately are talking about is something experienced by all kinds of people all the time.
And that's why I have so many contributors to the book, because I was like, this can't just be my story, because my story is other folks have similar stories to me, but it's also unique. And so if I can have other voices in this book, then my hope is that every reader will see themselves in this story somewhere.
And that is a really valuable aspect of the book. And I've heard you say in another interview, I don't want to write books by myself anymore. and I appreciate that there are other voices here, and I'm going to highlight a couple of them in just a moment. One of the things that's probably important for us to know about your experience in public schools in Syracuse, New York, is when it occurred, and the fact that, in your words, I was part of the ongoing desegregation experiment in our city schools. Explain the state of desegregation at that point in time and the way in which ultimately desegregation or integration was not handled very well at all in Syracuse and in lots of other places as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that's so unique about, or not unique about this story, is that like it takes place in Syracuse, New York, which is a mid-sized city in central New York, and like this kind of thing happened like not just in New York State, but like so many different other parts of the country. In particular, I think like the Midwest and the Northeast. We always learned that segregation was like a Southern thing. And that it was, you know, solved in 1954 with Brown versus the Board of Education, and kind of like thinking that in upstate New York, we're like, we're fine. We've got it. We've been like, you know, integrating well before like Brown versus the Board of Education. And so that was like the story we'd kind of been told, the story we felt. But when I was doing research for the book, And really looking at where our city was. I went to school in the like early 1980s. I think I started school in 1984. I started when I was three as a preschooler. And so I went to school in the 1980s and graduated from high school in 1999 and college in 2003. And so you'd think in the 80s, like 30 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, you'd be like, okay, we're doing okay. But really, you know, looking at the way the city tried to handle integration, there were so many missteps, as we see in states and cities across the country. And a part of that was the New York State Department of Education, like, had this rule that you couldn't have less than 15% or more than 45% Black students. And it was, like, always about, like, Black and white, too. And so with that, like, no school was supposed to have a majority of Black students and families, which just, like, astounds me and incredibly unfair and unjust, especially when we look at how neighborhoods are and were created because of redlining. And so our schools, like, were unbalanced according to the state. The school that I went to had about 52% Black students, so we were unbalanced. The school district tried to do integration by having, like, first, you know, volunteer busing, and that didn't work. And then by shutting down schools, and the schools they shut down were the ones that were predominantly Black. Like, there was a school up near the Syracuse University that was, like, almost all Black with a Black principal, Black teachers, incredible. And they shut that down, and those kids were bused to different schools. And then they started the magnet school movement. Magnet schools were pretty much created to really solve the problem of segregated schools and work on integrating. So I realized, like, my school that I went to was a fairly new magnet school, and we were, in fact, like, a part of the experiment in the city to, you know, the next wave of, like, hoping that they can integrate schools and meet those New York State mandates.
Right. You write at one point about how school integration seemed to never address root causes of the divide. They were looking mm-hmm. for quick fixes, and of course, those always proved to be elusive. I think one thing that is important about your book that also, I mean, as one looks at the book, at the title, one might not realize, you know, what a rich array of perspectives are part of it. I'm reminded of the opening words of a really interesting essay that you include from a writer by the name of James Byrd. He opens his essay with these words: "What I've learned about racism is that it doesn't always come at you swinging fists and spitting out slurs. It's not always violent and loud. Sometimes racism comes at you smiling." And I think he's, you know, he goes on to tell a story where I think we understand where he's coming from. But I mean, I really think that that's part of what your book is about, is that this is not about overt hatred. I mean, racism sort of cloaked in that where it's unmistakable, but that racism is sometimes born out of genuine concern, even kindness, but also from terrible misunderstanding about, you know, what's needed and what's really fair and so on. And I appreciate the fact that you go into depth and into some of the complexity of the various kinds of racism that you experienced during your schooling, both, you know, the deeply personal from individuals as well as systemic racism. I mean, you really try to tell that whole story.
Thank you for sharing. I love James's piece too. I was so, when he shared it with me, I was so excited to read it because it was a perspective that was totally different from mine, but also like, yeah, one that I totally got and understand. You know, how many times have we sat in classrooms or gone to banks or places where people have smiled at us and then like denied our rights? And so, yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Right. One of the things you say in your book is that third grade was a real turning point for you in terms of the way that you understood your school and your schooling. Explain what happened in third grade that changed things so dramatically for you.
Yeah. I wrote about this a little bit in my first book, too. I had a teacher who, she lived in the suburbs and her kids went to the, like, well-funded suburban school. And she was the kind of teacher who, I had great teachers, but she was not a great teacher. And she just says, like, she said things that were like very overtly biased and racist. I remember going home one day and telling my mom something she said, and my mom was just like, "What?" And the way that she treated students, like, it was very clear and obvious to me the way she treated darker students and black and brown students, you know, deny, like, you can't go to the bathroom, even though, like, it's, like, your right to go to the bathroom, and what she said. And so having her as a teacher and walking into the classroom every day and being like, she's still here, was one of those moments where I was like, this system isn't, like, really made for us. And this is coming from, like, I had an incredible second grade teacher who kept us close. She loved us. She trusted us. Like, we felt it, we knew it, into a classroom with a teacher who just, you could feel that she didn't care about us and that she was scared of us and that she didn't know what to do with us. And that, you know, third grade is also the year that we started taking tests, like statewide tests. And so that's also the year that you learn that you're measuring up or you're not measuring up to other kids in the state. And other kids in well-funded schools. And so, you know, I think it was like the following year we learned that our school was considered like a failing school from the test scores. And that, like, also, you know, we're like, how can we do well on tests when we don't even feel safe in our classrooms? So that was like one of those moments that, you know, and in talking with my mom about it, like, she reflected back to me, like, you know, like, you liked school, but you did not like that experience in third grade.
When you share with us a vision of how things could be profoundly better, fundamentally better, one of the things that I think you say so eloquently is the need to, in a sense, include everyone and everyone's story in what is taught and mm-hmm. what is shared in schools. At one point you write this, we need not just to see ourselves in the books we read, we need to know that we were limitless. We needed our voices, our thoughts, mm-hmm. our creativity, and our joy to be welcomed. And I think that that was a really eye-opening moment for me as someone who's white male, you know, privileged in so many ways, to, I don't know that I've ever really stopped to think about, let's call it the plight of a young mm-hmm. student who doesn't feel any of that, who feels when they are sitting in a classroom like this is all about someone else's life, someone else's world, right. someone else's reality. What would be one or two of the ways in which schools could do a better job of doing what you were just spelling out here?
Yeah. This is a question I ask kids whenever I work in a lot of schools too, and was recently talking to high schoolers and asked them, like, you know, what's something you wish you had that you didn't have or don't have at school? And so many of them, no matter like who they are, where they're from, like white kids, Indigenous kids, like all different kinds of kids will tell me like they want more time in school to understand who they are. They want to be able to explore their identities and learn about other people's identities. And they also want to like have time where they can ask questions and it not be shut down because like there's not enough time or because the teacher doesn't know, like to have time to do that exploration. And that's like across the board. Like, I wish I had that in school. And I went to school, you know, like I graduated in 1989. That was not that long ago, but it is not recent. And kids today are wanting the same thing that I wanted back then. And so there's something, like, we can do this. It's like, we can really easily give kids and students that time and space. If we like kind of reassess what is important and, you know, taking tests and isn't as important as like knowing who you are and the people around you are.
Right. I appreciate the time you take to talk about terminology. And you mentioned a couple of ones that I think are especially important. One is to stop talking about the achievement gap and start talking about the opportunity gap instead. And the other thing, you've already mentioned it or used it once in this interview, and that's the idea that that you are not part of a minority, but you are mm-hmm. Part of the global majority. Maybe pick one or the other and explain why that shift in terminology can really make a difference in helping us understand each other a whole lot better.
Yeah, I'll talk about minority a little bit because I think like for folks who aren't in education, like this will like meet them too. But I, you know, like I was always called a minority. You know, they're like the minority population, and that's always referring to Black, Indigenous people of color. And it felt really demeaning to be considered a minority, to be called like you're less than, you're literally like less than who the majority is in the country. But I heard the term people of the global majority years ago from a colleague who worked with Dr. Barbara J. Love, who does a lot of work around anti-racism and liberation. And I know other folks have used it too. And people of the global majority felt so empowering when I heard it. And it was one of those phrases that kind of like put a light bulb, like, hey, you know, like maybe in my college classroom, I was like the only person of color, but in the world, like there are whole continents where folks are Black and brown. And we continually discount that because of our like colonial mindset in this country. And so people of the global majority feels like is a reminder of like we are a collection of people around the world who can like amplify each other and uplift each other, and you never have to feel like you're less than because you're not. And so I think it's a really beautiful term.
I do too. I really, really loved your book. It gave me a lot to think about, and there are nearly 20 other writers whose work is represented mm-hmm. in this book called Everything I Learned About Racism I Learned in School. published by VersaFi, a division of HarperCollins, the author Tiffany Jewell. Tiffany Jewell, thank you for this book, and thank you for this privilege to speak with you today. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you so much.